of the former leader of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. The participants praised the sterling quality of his character, especially his selfless fight against terrorist groups.
He was keen for his fight against this terrorism, and he need to be remembered. We must remember General Qasem Soleimani for his bravery and standing against injustice. He fight against the extrajudicial killing of innocent people by the so-called ISIS and other terrorist organizations.
General Soleimani and his fellow Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were assassinated in a targeted drone attack on the 3rd of January 2020 in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, with orders from then US President Donald Trump. People here say the assassination of General Soleimani has revealed the true identity of terror sponsors to the world.
Those that claim to be fighting against terrorism kill a hero, somebody who fights against terrorism. Now, who are the terrorists? America is the perpetrators of terrorism in the world. It is very clear to the whole world that these are the global sponsors and perpetrators of terrorism in the world.
Military hospital.
In a message to the occasion, Nigeria's senior Muslim cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki said the Islamic movement in Nigeria will continue to mark the assassination of General Soleimani, just like it marks other martyrs in Karbala, Zaria, and other places. Nigerians who gathered here say they share the pain of the Iranian people and indeed of all law-abiding nations of the world who stand against extrajudicial killing like that of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. government. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
After almost 140 days of his hunger strike, the 40-year-old Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is in imminent danger, facing the risk of sudden death at any moment. Representatives of Palestinian factions and prisoners' advocacy groups in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets again, sounding the alarm over the health condition of Abu Hawash, who is protesting his illegal administrative detention without charge or trial.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined Hisham. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has meanwhile issued a statement demanding Israel to immediately release Abu Hawash. Israel claims it keeps some Palestinians behind bars without disclosing sensitive information that could expose valuable sources. In the case of Abu Hawash, Israeli intelligence claims he's an activist of the jihad movement. However, it was not able to provide explicit evidence in support of its allegations. Palestinian human rights organizations say it's yet another attempt to bring Palestinian prisoners to their knees and prevent them from being engaged in any form of struggle.
My brother Hisham could die at any moment. This is according to medical reports by the doctors who have directly examined him. We are really worried about his health. Israel is using a new form of assassination against our brothers.
Last month, the Israeli regime accepted to release hunger-striking prisoner Kaid al-Fasfus after 131 days of his protest, where his release was seen as yet another form of victory. As Israel reportedly holds over 4,500 Palestinian prisoners, hundreds of them are languishing behind bars without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. Palestinians pray that Abu Hawash's life could be saved before it's too late. Abu Hawash, who's literally on the verge of death, has said before his health severely deteriorated that he will continue his hunger strike until victory. That is, according to him, his release or his martyrdom. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Inside the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, Iranian judicial experts gathered to reveal the details of a probe into the U.S. assassination of Iranian top military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. General Soleimani was the commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was assassinated in January 2020 in a U.S. drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then U.S. President Donald Trump.
The U.S. justifies its crime by branding it as self-defense or targeted killing. There is no such legal term in the international law. It is an assassination and cannot be justified by vague terms. It's an extrajudicial murder which violates the UN resolutions 1368 and 1370. Furthermore, based on the Chicago Convention, the use of UAVs in another sovereign country requires a permission of that country. Iraq says it did not give such a permission to the U.S. to carry out this strike.
Iran and Iraq have formed a joint investigation committee comprised of Iraqi and Iranian judicial experts. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, more than 120 people have been identified in connection with General Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
General Soleimani was on a mission to Iraq, a mission that concerns the fight against terrorism. The Convention on Special Missions protects the rights of General Soleimani, but Washington breached that convention as well. So all these violations of international law are considered a crime, and we are taking the case to international judicial bodies to penalize the perpetrators.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from the terror group. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists, something which experts say leads to a safe interpretation that Washington must be on the terrorists' team.
2 years have passed since General Soleimani was assassinated, and Iran is still as resolute to prosecute those behind the incident. Iran's judiciary calls the culprits the terrorists' comrades, saying it will not stop until all perpetrators are brought to justice. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In a press conference in the capital Sana'a, Yemen's Eye for Humanity Center for Rights and Development released its new report on the Saudi crimes committed against Yemenis during 2021. The report highlights the number of victims of the Saudi air attacks and the destruction of the country's infrastructure.
Recently, the Saudi-led coalition has escalated its raids against civilian facilities and residential areas crowded with civilians in Yemen and tried to justify this by saying that there were military activities in those areas, which was not true. We monitor all the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and the victims who fall in Saudi airstrikes and mortar shelling.
The report says Saudi warplanes have launched over 9,900 airstrikes against civilian facilities across Yemen last year, killing 387 civilians, including 96 children, and injuring hundreds more. In a previous report, the human rights group said more than 43,000 civilians had been hurt or killed in relentless airstrikes across Yemen since Saudi Arabia launched a war on its southern neighbor in 2015. It said nearly 4,000 children were among those killed.
As people around the world celebrate the New Year with festivals and joyful events, Yemenis enter a new year of war and siege imposed on their country by Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the years-long resistance will eventually bring Riyadh to justice for its crimes in Yemen. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei, Lady Fatima was an ocean of wisdom and piety. July the 5th, 2007. Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could make a person become such an ocean of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? This is a miracle of Islam. The love of Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, also known as Siddiqatul Kubra, is a great blessing for us. In her short life, Fatima al-Zahra, Salamullah alayha, achieved the position of the mistress of all women. In other words, she is superior to all great and saintly women throughout history. What factors, forces, and what kind of inner strength could make a person become such an ocean of wisdom, piety, sanctity, and spiritual transcendence in such a short time? Well, this is a miracle of Islam. Another point is the blessed descendants of this great person. The association of Suratul Kawthar with Fatima al-Zahra, even if such an association had not existed in our hadith collections, is an accurate association. There are so many blessings that have been bestowed on the Holy Prophet's household and on each and every one of the Imams, alayhim as-salam.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The world is full of enjoyable individual, social, worldly and otherworldly melodies which came out of the pure throats of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, Husayn ibn Ali, Zainab al-Kubra, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam Sadiq, Imam Sajjad, and each and every one of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, would produce these melodies. See what a great excitement exists in the world of spirituality and in the path of guidance because of the words of these great personalities and their lessons and teachings. They are the children of Fatima al-Zahra, alayha salam. We should sincerely thank God. A number of the poems which are recited by the friends contained this point. The love of Fatima al-Zahra, alayha salam, also known as Siddiqatul Kubra, is a great blessing for us. Thank God we became familiar with her. Thank God we relied on her kindness and thank God we appreciated her value. Thank God we relied on her, asked her to help us gain an understanding of things and expressed our love for her. These are great blessings. We should preserve these blessings. That was the leader's speech from July the 5th, 2007.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the illegal act of detainment without charge, Israel is the one that has taken the lead in this regard. But this act is being defeated through Palestinian hunger strikers like Hisham Abu Hawash, who was detained without charge or trial. He ended a 141-day hunger strike after reaching a deal with Israel to be released on February 26. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Israel continues this illegal act while the world stands idly by and watches it, along with other Israeli atrocities that continue in the occupied territories.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days. But he's finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people, and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Cates. She's an international coordinator at the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, Mazen Kumsaya, Palestinian scientist and author, who joins us from Bethlehem.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. And Mazin Khumsaya, let me first start with you. Administrative detention may be familiar to us, but maybe for some it's not. If you can please explain to us what it is that is causing this controversy, what is the definition of it, and why does Israel, in this case, employ execute it?
Well, first we congratulate the family of Hisham for finally having this agreement to release him and thus breaking his fast. He is one of many who are subjected to these cruel and unusual circumstances that are forbidden by international law. We have to remember that Israel is breaking records in these things. It's breaking records in having the longest held political prisoner, Nail Barghouti, over 41 years in prison so far. There's other people, stories that are really sad, like Nasser Abu Hamid, who has cancer, who's also fasting. He entered into a coma yesterday. He's been in prison since 2002. And he has four brothers who are in prison. Their home was destroyed over five times. Another cruel and unusual punishment that Israel engages in. There is Khalid Fasfous, who has entered into his 131st day of fasting, and his life is also threatened. So there are stories upon stories upon stories that one could tell, all in violation of international law, that Israel does its thing and gets away with it.
All right. Charlotte Cates, our guest there, and we appreciate Mazin Khumsaya for mentioning some of the other people who are actually in Israeli jails, and some who are on a hunger strike that are continuing with it. Why do you think Israel agreed to actually release this particular prisoner, given the fact that it could have opted not to? But Hisham Abu Hawash was able to get a deal with Israel and for Israel to then release him. And why is it that is seen by many as a big success when it comes to Palestinians?
Well, administrative detention, I mean, which is the particular kind of imprisonment under which Hisham Abu Hawash was held, is a form of torture in many ways, including psychological torture, because of the fact that Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention never know when they are going to be released, and neither do their families. They're not able to make plans for the future. They're not able to think about what they're going to be doing in the future because of the fact that Israel even refuses not only to charge them or to try them, but to even give them a date of release. The reason why Hisham Abu Hawash and, of course, many other hunger strikers in the past have been able to extract a victory from the occupation is because of their own steadfastness, their own resistance, their leadership in the Palestinian prisoners movement, which plays a leading role in the Palestinian liberation struggle, and of course the power and strength and commitment of the Palestinian resistance, which repeatedly expressed its commitment to see the liberation of Hisham Abu Hawash and to see the liberation of all Palestinian prisoners. And so Hisham's victory is not just a victory for himself, but one for the entire Palestinian National Liberation Movement, and really for all people who care about justice in the world. Right now, there is a boycott of the Israeli military courts that's being carried out by over 500 administrative detainees. And this gives that entire movement strength and further support to move forward and to win a victory against administrative detention.
What is this thing that you just mentioned about the court? You can just elaborate for us briefly.
Sure. Well, on the 1st of January of this year, the administrative detainees, there are over 500 Palestinians held without charge or trial under indefinitely renewable administrative detention orders, which are put in place via a secret file. And they're among over 4,500 Palestinian political prisoners in total held within the Israeli occupation prisons. They announced on the 1st of this year that they were launching a full boycott of the Israeli military courts and higher courts because these courts are nothing more than a facade that presents the false image that there is some kind of legal process going on, when in reality there is nothing more than rubber stamping the arbitrary detention orders of the Israeli intelligence service, the Shin Bet.
Sure. And that's important. And if you can tell us, Mazin Khumsaya, why this boycott is important. Because from what I'm understanding, it takes away the legitimacy that Israel wants to portray, as our guest there said, if I'm correct to understand it that way.
Indeed, you know, Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East when it is the worst offender of human rights in the world today in many, many aspects. It's an apartheid racist regime that has two sets of laws, one set of real laws for Jews and one set that's reserved for the what they consider inferior human beings, which are the native Palestinians, indigenous people. Our lives here are guided basically by the whims and whimsical interests of military commanders who obviously have only one interest in mind, which is the advancement of colonization on our land, which means more theft of land and more destruction of homes. That's basically the whole process of colonization, built on this idea of giving it a quasi-legal structure so that the world, you know, it's a public relations thing, so that the world says, well, there is Israeli courts and so on. But as pointed out by the other speaker, these are only rubber stamping, basically, whatever the military and the Israeli government decides to do to finish off and liquidate the Palestinian struggle.
Okay, let's get a little bit beyond the prisoner plight here, of which we have talked about somewhat briefly. And I'm looking, Charlotte Cates, at something that's very disturbing that I see every week, if not daily, but I see it every week. And I'm not too sure if the world is seeing it every week, but they should. And my point of reference here is a source by the name of Palestinian Center for Human Rights. And when I look at the weekly report that comes out in this particular website of the different violations that happen in the occupied territories, among the different ones, which is a long list, the one that I'm reading, December 23 through the 29th, the Israeli military had 101, in 1 week now, 101 incursions into the occupied West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, 60 Palestinians arrested, including six children. 1 week. Every week, more or less, along the same numbers, if not more, sometimes less. Why is this not being highlighted in order for the plight of people for just this one particular reason, which is the illegal detainment? Why isn't that just being highlighted when it's happening on a weekly basis?
Well, in 2021 alone, over 8,000 Palestinians were arrested during the year. And of course, sometimes when we look at the number of prisoners, the number of arrests, we don't really see reflected in those figures. And this is especially true for child detainees, because of the fact that they might be held for several days. And during this time, they're subjected to solitary confinement, to military interrogations, to various forms of torture and abuse. And, you know, even if they are released afterwards, rather than being sent to a military court, the severe effects of that kind of mistreatment on Palestinian children continue to affect them for years and years to come. And so sometimes even when we talk about the fact that there are 200 Palestinian children right now locked in Israeli occupation prisons, it doesn't convey the full sense of the violence that's being committed against Palestinian children and against the Palestinian people as a whole. In Samidun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, and many organizations around the world are working hard to bring attention to this issue and to free all Palestinian prisoners, and of course to bring in Zionist colonialism throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea, because this is the only way to really bring an end to these kinds of ongoing violations and ongoing attacks. And there are many organizations that are involved in this effort. And so one of the most important things that people can do when they hear about this situation is to get involved with a group in your area, get involved with building the boycott of Israel, get involved in sharing this information on social media, because the imperialist powers that are allied with the Israeli occupation are not going to tell this story for us. Instead, it's very important that we tell this story ourselves and do everything we can in the streets to build power and give support to Palestinian prisoners who are leading in the resistance and the Palestinian people who are fighting back for liberation and return.
Sure. And this fight back came recently, something that was hailed across the Palestinian territories, Masinkum Saya. And that was the breakout that happened, or a jailbreak that happened by the six Palestinians, which was described as a Hollywood-style escape from an Israeli prison. It was hailed as a big deal. And tell us why that is. And tell us whether that kind of sparked what we're seeing, acts of resistance, which is an increase, as we've now seen with these Israeli hunger-striking prisoners.
Yes, and you know, the breakout of an Israeli prison like that was a heroic act, and it's almost like a Hollywood-style movie that they managed to escape from maximum security prison. But I do want to add one thing to what was said about the prisoner situation. There are groups that try to defend prisoners, including Defense of Children International and groups that are prisoner rights groups. Israel is actually outlawing these groups, and they have outlawed 7 human rights groups just in the past 6 months. And those 7 human rights groups are considered by Israel to be quote-unquote terrorist groups. So even human rights groups and groups that defend prisoners are outlawed here, and effective resistance is being targeted in every aspect, regardless of the form of resistance. It's not just armed resistance, but any kind of resistance, any kind of nonviolent even resistance, any kind of demonstrations, any kind of even expression of opinions on Facebook and other media outlets are considered taboo and prevented here, and are attacked here, and the people are punished for them. Israel has developed a system of repression that really is the envy of fascists and Nazis, for example. I think they have really created a system that's very, very strong and mean and powerful. But in opposition to that is, as we said, we are struggling, and we engage in boycott, and we engage in divestment, sanctions, and we are very proud of support of groups like and people like Desmond Tutu, who died recently, a friend of mine, and others. Really, we are very grateful for international mobilization, and the right will eventually win. I am very, very hopeful, and I'm very optimistic about this.
Well, the landscape as it stands, and maybe you can tell us if you agree or not, Charlotte Cates, is it looks like Israel is penetrable. When you take a look at what happened with that prison break, when you take a look at you know, how this hunger strike that was conducted, in which a deal was set and Israel agreed to release him, the topic of our program. When you take a look at the most recent Gaza war, where you had these rockets actually penetrate the so-called Israel's Iron Dome system, and also many reports coming out saying that the Israeli army, its soldiers, they're not really even prepared for a war. It kind of shows Israel in a weak state. Is that correct to look at Israel that way?
Because, you know, Israel has a lot of weaponry. It has a lot of technological power. It's given $3.8 billion a year by the United States, which, you know, there's been another $1 billion added to this. And this money goes straight to weaponry, right? And so you also have the unlimited political and diplomatic support given by not just the U.S., but other imperialist powers in Europe and Canada and elsewhere. But what you also have is the fundamental weakness of the imposition of a Zionist regime in the middle of this region as an imperialist outpost. And there's a fundamental illegitimacy to that project of Zionism within the region. And this is being rejected by the Arab people, by the people of the region, and certainly by the Palestinian people. And so when we see things like the victories of the Palestinian resistance, when we see things like the growing strength of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza and elsewhere, when we look at the 6 prisoners who escaped in this heroic, you know, action from Gilboa, one reason why this inspired Palestinians everywhere, inside Palestine and exile and diaspora, and also people struggling for justice in Palestine everywhere around the world, is because it exposed the cracks and flaws and weaknesses in this technological superiority that is enjoyed by the Israeli occupation state. And so all of this must actually inspire us to redouble our efforts to strengthen our work to build the boycott and isolation of Israel, because we know that it is possible for Israel to lose. We know that it is possible for the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to win. And so this is the moment to escalate solidarity. This is the moment to escalate the isolation of Israeli apartheid immediately.
Okay, you talked about that very well. And Mazen Kumsaya, with the rejection of Israel and what it is doing has been, since you mentioned Desmond Tutu, I'm making a comparison here, that the apartheid policies of the Israeli regime, the comparison is made there. And many have concluded, whether it's analysts, politicians even, that you know, this is not going to last. You even have Hollywood rejecting Israel. I'm not going to name the Hollywood actress who recently displayed solidarity with the Palestinians, because I'll get faulted for mentioning her name in terms of any endorsement, which obviously I'm not going to do. But even there, where Israel is said to have a hold on Hollywood, it's being rejected. What will it take then for this regime to lose the right of doing what it's doing in the occupied territories?
I mean, oppressors do not easily give up. They do not easily hand over power. Oppressors have to be forced to hand over power. They have to be forced to do what is right. That's why it's essential to apply this pressure in all aspects of resistance, all aspects of boycott, divestments, media work. All of this is very, very critical. I think the biggest obstacle actually for us is not the power of the Israeli military might. The biggest obstacle for us is the collaborationist Arab regimes and even among the Palestinian leadership who think that Israel is invincible and that Israel is here to last forever, and you might as well just collaborate and have normalization with it like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and others have done. Those are much more of a danger to us than the military might of Israel or its support from the West. There was a lot of support and military might for South Africa under apartheid, and it crumbled because of public pressure. But the important thing, just like with South Africa, not to have too many Chief Buthelezi of South Africa, not to have too many people here of the Palestinian leadership who meet with Israeli military leaders and wait okay. for the crumbs of the table to come down their way. This is a big obstacle for us. That's what we have to overcome.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. We're fresh out of time. Mazen Kumsaya there, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. Charlotte Cates, thank you so much. International coordinator at the Summit and Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, who spoke to us from Vancouver. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. From Mikko Vitarvay, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Growing drive-by hardcore Trumpists spurs U.S. election watchdogs to voice alarm about threat to America's democracy. Here we present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled Bannon and Allies Bid to Expand Pro-Trump Influence in Local U.S. Politics. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Key Donald Trump loyalists Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn are at the forefront of a drive to expand Trumpist influence at the local level of U.S. politics, while forging ahead with efforts aimed at promoting baseless claims that Joe Biden's 2020 election victory was fraudulent. The growing drive by Trump's hardcore allies has spurred election watchdog groups to voice alarm about the threat to democracy posed by Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon, and other Trump acolytes, as they combine debunk claims about election fraud and calls for further 2020 election audits, with planning conservative takeovers of official positions that run U.S. elections. The moves come a year after the attack on the Capitol in Washington, when a pro-Trump mob invaded the building in an attempt to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory. Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon, using varying paths, have focused new energy on increasing conservative influence by recruiting more allies for key posts at the local and precinct level, with an eye on the 2022 and 2024 elections, and building more political alliances on issues such as vaccine requirements and mask mandates. The strategies Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon are deploying overlap those of other conservative outfits, such as the influential youth group Turning Point USA, to expand the pro-Trump base at the precinct level and work to elect Trump-backed politicians to key posts, such as Secretary of State in Georgia, in Arizona, and in various other battleground states. Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon have separately relied on a mix of non-profit groups, including one backed by the multimillionaire Patrick Byrne, conservative social media outlets favored by the far right, like Telegram, and events that convey evangelical Christian messages with political disinformation. Steve Bannon, for instance, has used his War Room podcast to espouse plans for taking over the Republican Party through the precinct committee strategy, and invited would-be candidates to appear as guests. He claimed the podcast, which has millions of downloads, has found a large and receptive conservative following. Meanwhile, Michael Flynn touts the adage that local action has national impact, and has been a star speaker in several key states at Reawaken America events, which are dubbed Health and Freedom Conferences and combine evangelical themes with misinformation about the 2020 presidential election and vaccine skepticism. The conservative crusades by Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon come after Donald Trump pardoned them post-election for lying to the FBI and fraud, respectively. Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn also were central actors with other Trump loyalists in scheming about ways to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election, efforts that are under scrutiny as part of the House Select Committee investigation of the deadly Capitol attack by hundreds of Donald Trump supporters. As they have carved out new roles in the conservative ecosystem, Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon still support Trump's conspiratorial claims that he lost in 2020 due to massive cheating, a mantra that reinforces their drives to expand local and state electoral influence to give Republicans a better shot at recapturing Congress next year and the White House in 2024. J. Joanna Lithgate, chief executive of the state's United Democracy Center, said in a statement to The Guardian, "We're seeing a dangerous trend of election deniers lining up to fill election administration positions across the country." She added, "And the efforts by Michael Flynn, Steve Bannon, and other promoters of the big lie are all part of this playbook to hijack elections in 2022 and 2024 if their preferred candidate doesn't win." Likewise, as they have revved up political work on multiple fronts, the two ex-Trump advisers have taken more extremist stances, sparking strong criticism. Michael Flynn, a retired Army Lieutenant General, has been skewed for his authoritarian-style advocacy of one religion for America, and for speaking at some events with heavy presences by adherents of QAnon conspiracy movement. Michael Flynn's call for one religion came during a talk to a conservative Christian audience in Texas on the Reawaken America tour last November. Michael Flynn said, "If we're going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion. One nation under God and one religion under God, right? All of us working together." According to Patrick Byrne, the multimillionaire founder of America Project that counts Michael Flynn as special advisor and spokesperson, Flynn's feature role at Reawaken America meetings in several states such as Michigan and Florida is hardly an accident. Patrick Byrne, who has joined Michael Flynn at some Reawaken rallies, said in text messages that he and Flynn had a large hand in launching the Reawaken tour during the spring, by bankrolling the events with some tens of thousands of dollars from the America Project. Overall, Byrne said that the America Project has raised about $9.5 million, of which he donated close to $7 million. Patrick Byrne and the America Project poured over $3 million into a months-long audit of Arizona's largest county, which Donald Trump was banking on to find major fraud, but which resulted in no significant changes to Joe Biden's win there or overall in the state, much to Donald Trump's dismay. Patrick Byrne said the project has helped promote audits in other states besides Arizona, boasting a net worth about $75 million. Byrne is the ex-chief executive of furniture retailer Overstock. Patrick Byrne texted that he didn't vote for Donald Trump and deems himself a rule of law advocate who claims there's still a mountain of evidence to support the widely debunked allegations of voter fraud. Patrick Byrne's project has had no dearth of Trump links. The project's president until late last month was Emily Newman, a former Trump aide. According to multiple reports, Emily Newman, along with Patrick Byrne and Michael Flynn, attended a meeting in December of 2020 with Donald Trump about ways to block Joe Biden taking office, where Michael Flynn touted the option of declaring martial law and deploying the military to rerun the election in key states that Donald Trump lost. Patrick Byrne said Flynn's brother, Joe Flynn, has succeeded Emily Newman as the project's president. On top of his work with the America Project, Flynn's focus on expanding the MAGA base at the local level increased when he became chairman in May of another non-profit, America's Venture, which in turn has partnered with Turing Point USA and others to form a larger alliance dubbed County Citizens Defending Freedom USA. According to Florida lawyer Ron Filipkowski, a former prosecutor who authored a Washington Post article on the wave of local drives by Trump backers, the County Citizens Group has sponsored an array of training programs, protests, and candidate meetings with a focus on mask mandates, vaccine requirements and critical race theory. For his part, Steve Bannon's heavy emphasis on a local precinct strategy to help Republicans' electoral fortunes combines conspiratorial and apocalyptic bravado. Steve Bannon told CNN in December that his War Room podcast is an organizing tool to expand Donald Trump's base. Bannon said, "It is about winning elections with the right people, MAGA people. We will have our people in at every level." Bannon said in November on his War Room podcast, "We're taking over all the elections. We're going to get to the bottom of last year's election and we're going to decertify the electors. And you're going to have a constitutional crisis. But you know what? We're a big and tough country and we can handle that. We'll be able to handle that. We'll get through that." Megan Squire, a computer science professor at Elon University, told The Guardian that much of Steve Bannon's political messaging has relied on alternative social media channels, such as Telegram, that appeal to conservative and far-right allies to spread pro-Trump gospel and help broaden the MAGA base at the local level. To Megan Squire, Steve Bannon's rhetoric and large audience look increasingly dangerous. Megan Squire said, "After being deplatformed from mainstream social media over the past year, Bannon has been promoting alternative, permissive social media channels such as Telegram and Get. There, his listeners are able to amplify and intensify Bannon's messaging into a 24-hour-a-day echo chamber filled with disinformation, scams, and conspiracy theories." For Joanna Lydgate, the chief executive of the state's United Democracy Center, the multi-front drives by Steve Bannon, Michael Flynn, and other key Trump loyalists pose serious risks for the integrity of future elections. She said, "They want to sow doubt in our democracy and make it easier to undermine the will of the American voters."